Welcome to Podcast Against Antisemitism, the show that takes a deep dive into the world's oldest hatred. I'm Ellie, your host, and you can join us for new episodes every Thursday. Subscribe now at antisemitism.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss a show. You can also watch the podcast on our YouTube channel. And please consider leaving us a nice review so we can grow our listenership. It makes a big difference. My guest today is Dr. Sheila Nazarian, an award-winning Jewish Iranian-American plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills and the star of the Emmy-nominated Netflix series Skin Decision Before and After. She has also guest-starred on numerous other television series, including The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Basketball Wives, and Revenge Body with Khloe Kardashian. Dr. Nazarian is the host of The Closet, a podcast where she engages with activists and change makers in intimate conversations live from her closet. She is also an activist against antisemitism and uses her large platform to speak out against hatred towards Jews. Dr. Nazarian, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Ollie. Thanks for having me. This is such a pleasure.
Now, look, first of all, am I right in thinking that you are now recording from your closet?
I am. This is where it all happens.
Oh my God, what a thrill. So look, you are based in Los Angeles, which has been somewhat of a hotbed for anti-Semitic incidents as of late, notably the distribution of neo-Nazi propaganda. When anti-Semitism has reached such a level that it permeates beyond the consciousness of just the Jewish community and into that of the mainstream, to the extent that people like celebrities, like former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, has to release videos addressing it. What are you thinking?
I mean, I think that for me, you know, being an Iranian first generation refugee, really having escaped Iran and seeing what kind of socialism has done to our countries. I feel like a lot of the Russian Jews, Cuban Jews, South American Jews. I know you mentioned, you know, the neo-Nazi propaganda. I am less afraid of those people, and I'm more afraid of left-leaning legislatures who are well-funded and actually in a position of power to pass laws, change the curriculum to take out Holocaust education. That's where the real threat to me is coming from, is the anti-Semitism cloaked in progressivism, just because I've smelled that before in Iran. And so for me, neo-Nazis, who the KKK has about 5,000 members, they're weak, they're not funded, they basically have zero power, and they're running around burning tiki torches. That's less threatening to me than people in positions of power who can actually create real change for the masses. So that's what scares me.
What are your thoughts on what we're seeing right now on university campuses? We're seeing a lot of anti-Semitism, specifically in the form of the demonization of Zionism, equating Zionism with racism, from the river to the sea chants, that sort of thing.
Right. And so, you know, what I do is I speak on a lot of college campuses to encourage the Jewish students to not hide, to speak up, to educate, to go to administration. And so I think the messaging there is don't hide, don't change who you are or suppress parts of who you are in order to feel accepted. You know, if they, like, again, in Iran, when you were canceled, you disappeared for 2 weeks and came back a vegetable, or you just disappeared, period. Here, they try to go after character assassination or bad grades or job prospects, but it's still the same kind of bullying and it's the same kind of censorship. So what I try to do is tell Jewish students on campus to be loud, be proud, go to administration. I just spoke to a student in a South American country who took a course that was mandatory in her theology major. And the entire course was about the demonization of Israel and Jews. That was all that was on the curriculum. And that's not what the course was meant to teach. She took it to administration. Yeah. It's the first time in the history of the university that they're firing a tenured professor. They have made it so that they have to review the syllabus of every professor before it's taught. And one student did that. So what we have to do is empower people to fight for the right thing, to fight for justice, and to speak up.
Most definitely. Now, I want to know, in your opinion, what are some of the motivating factors behind the spike? A recent FBI report said from 2020 to 2021, there was a nearly 20% jump in anti-Jewish incidents. So in your opinion, what do you think are some of the things causing this?
Well, I think anti-Semitism is always there, right? It's always kind of underlying everything, and it's the comfort with which it bubbles to the surface. Now, we've seen this before, right? We've seen how in the past in Europe, instead of saying we don't like, you know, Jews, we don't like Israel, or we're anti-Zionist, we're not anti-Semitic. But what people don't understand is that Judaism is an ethno-religion. Like no other religion with the current, you know, meaning of the word religion, no other religion, when you do your genetic testing, comes back and says 10% Jewish, 20% Jewish. So we all come from that land, Judea and Samaria. Our DNA comes from that land. You don't do 23andMe or genetic testing, it doesn't say 50% Christian. No other, you know, religion, by what we define it today, comes up in your genetic testing. If they bury me in 1,000 years from now, people find my bones and evaluate it, they will know that I was Jewish. No other religion has that. So we are, our DNA is tied to that land. So when you are asking a Jewish person, give up your ties to that land in order to be accepted on campus or at the workplace or in music or in Hollywood, we cannot do it. You're asking us to separate our DNA from the land of Israel. We cannot do that. No Jew can do that. Even if they say they will, they're not, they can't. So again, I saw a stat that said 85% or 90% of Jews feel a connection to the land of Israel. Why? Because our DNA goes back to that. It's mentioned in our upbringing bazillion times. So when you say you're anti-Zionist, it is the same thing as saying you're anti-Jew. The Israeli flag has a big Jewish Star of David in the middle of it. So we just call out to everyone, we cannot as Jews separate ourselves from our DNA. No one can. Jewish or not, can't separate yourself from your DNA, and no one should ask you to do that. And if anyone does, like they're just anti-Semitic because they don't, or they're uneducated. They don't understand what I just said.
Let me ask you. You are a Persian Jew living in the United States. There's so many different kinds of Jews in the United States. What has your experience been as a Persian Jew?
Well, I think the Persian Jews, you know, were first generation. Most of us came in the 80s or the, you know, 70s, around the revolution in Iran. The Shah was very good to the Jews. And when the Islamic clerics took over, it went back to not being great for the Jews in Iran. They would bother us. There was overt discrimination. There was, whispered discrimination. Wasn't great for girls, as you can see with everything happening in Iran right now and the revolution led by women there. My parents just knew that it wasn't a great place for girls, and thank God they left everything. My dad left a very successful life in Iran to bring us with my mom, my mother, and my sister to America. We actually did have to escape through the desert on the back of a pickup truck. We were in Pakistan for 3 months waiting for visas to be able to get out. Thank God we were able to make it to the amazing United States that, based on your character, your drive, your core values, your talent, you can succeed. And I just want to remind people again, listening to this podcast, that, you know, Persian Jews, Russian Jews, Cuban Jews, South American Jews, anyone who has lived through massive discrimination, is so, so grateful to be in America. And I think that when everything started happening with the conflict in Israel and people were kind of shaming, you know, Jews, there's good Jews and there's bad Jews, it was a matter of survival to me. And I was posting about 8.5 hours a day, in addition to having 3 children and a husband and a surgery job and all of that. It was a matter of core values. It was a matter of survival. And I just felt I can't let America go down. Like, America has been so amazing to my community and so many other communities.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's so powerful when someone like you was saying it, who literally fled persecution in Iran. By the way, if you don't mind my asking, what was that like? Do you remember much of that experience?
Yeah. So we left towards the tail end of the Iran-Iraq war. There was bombs flying everywhere. My parents could see that there was really no future as Jews and as, you know, women in Iran for their two daughters. And so my father actually said he was going on a medical conference in the U.S., went to Vienna, stayed there with a friend, a colleague, and worked on getting visas for my mother and my sister and I. Meanwhile, about a week later, my mom, my sister, and I went to the bazaar. We got into the back of a truck in the fetal position with strangers, kind of just, you know, fitting in however we can. They put burlap on top of us and corn and took us close to the border. I remember there was like a pole at the bottom of the truck that I guess they used to tie, you know, crop to, that was sticking into my ribs. And I kept telling my mom, that hurts. And she's like, shh, just be quiet, just be quiet. So we got close to the Pakistani border. And that's when she told me, in like a makeshift hut of a bathroom that was basically made of clay and it was a big hole in the ground. She told me we were going to America, and I had a lot of the bootleg, like Michael Jackson videos. So I was like so excited to meet Michael Jackson once we made it to America. And so we slept one night in the desert, and the next day we were seen by border police. They started shooting at us, and we were, thank God, able to get away. And we made it into Pakistan, and we were in Pakistan for a few months with other people that had escaped, Muslim, Jewish, Baha'i. And eventually we were able to make it to America.
That's an unbelievable story. That is absolutely unbelievable. So look, you made it to America, you grew up and you became a plastic surgeon. Let's talk about that. Did you know that you always wanted to become a plastic surgeon?
No, I was always really crafty. So even when we were, you know, coming to America, I made a suitcase out of paper bags and duct tape. And that's sort of what I carried my stuff in. And my mom used to call me متخصص کارهای بیخودی, which means the expert in useless things. And so she used to say, stop doing that, go throw a ball around, like go get some exercise. But I was always like super crafty, and I love to measure things and to like build things. So I did wood shop in the fourth grade when I was in elementary school, and I really loved that. So I said, okay, maybe I want to be an architect or an orthopedic surgeon, just because I love hammers and nails and designing the things. So for architecture, I didn't want to be behind a desk. I wanted to actually build. So that was off the table. And then I started following around in college a orthopedic surgeon. And it was very cookie cutter too, not as much creativity as I would like. So one of my friends was like, hey, why don't you look into plastic surgery? And so I did, and I loved it. And here I am.
Hey, if you want to stay up to date with the fight against anti-Semitism, why not subscribe to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? Visit antisemitism.org/act or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. Now, I wanna talk about your show, but before I get onto that, I wanted to ask you this. There is a lot of anti-Semitic propaganda surrounding the Jewish nose, which has unfortunately, but perhaps understandably, caused many Jewish people to develop a complex about their nose. As a plastic surgeon who also fights anti-Semitism, I would be very interested to hear your thoughts on Jewish people deciding that they feel that they need rhinoplasty, also known as a nose job, due to insecurities about their nose.
I'm not sure if the insecurity comes because it's a Jewish nose. I just look at things anatomically, and I look at things aesthetically, whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish, it doesn't matter. I think that I just look at people's proportions on the face and try to, you know, see what is anatomically most functional and aesthetic for them. So I always tell people, regardless, if there's something that bothers you and you think about it more than 3 times a week and you're healthy and it's safe to fix it, just fix it. Like, you can use that brain power on something so much more productive and actually do good for the world, rather than thinking about this thing that bothers you. Now, with that said, I actually stopped doing noses because I hate doing noses. I stopped doing noses about a year into practice, just because you work so hard to architecturally like manufacture this amazing work of art. And then at 1 year, the cartilage has memory. So it just goes like, and you're like, no. Oh, no. So, you know, with breasts, you do a breast, it comes down a little. It just looks more natural. It looks better, you know? So I just feel like the hard work that I put in, I don't want the body to kind of work against me. And I always tell people, you know, if you bought one nose job, you bought two, or you bought your third one, because the cartilage does what the cartilage does. And so I stopped doing noses, but no, I think that whether you're Jewish, non-Jewish, if there's something that you think will make you feel more confident, I think of it almost like self-care. I think of it as a facial or getting some jeans that make your butt look good. Like it's all, if you feel good and you're confident, you're going to do good things for the world. And that's going to have ripple effects on everyone around you. So I just think of plastic surgery, all plastic surgery, whether it's a cleft lip, hand surgery, microsurgery after cancer, all of that is about quality of life. And I think aesthetic surgery is no different than that.
Right, right. Now let's talk about the show. You are the star of the Emmy-nominated series Skin Decision, Before and After. In the reality show, viewers are presented with people who, for various reasons, dislike something about their body. And much of the time, the reasons for the not liking their body is because they were involved in some traumatic incidents that have altered their appearances. What was the most difficult part about filming the show, and what was the most hard-hitting story that you came across?
I think the most difficult part of filming a show like that is with plastic surgery, you don't get the final result for like a year, year and a half, sometimes 2 years for the scars to evolve and for the swelling to completely go away. But when you're in Hollywood land, you get about three and a half months, maybe 4 months to film most of the time. So I think that a lot of the patients a year out from the procedures that we did look obviously great. But for me as a plastic surgeon, being hypercritical of my work always and always trying to improve, it was, you know, tough having to present people at 3.5 months or 2 months or even 1 month, depending on when they had their procedure done. So I think the hardest part was the time limit of the filming. And the most hard-hitting story was probably the first episode. There was a patient that was shot by her husband 9 times. Their children, he also killed himself, and she survived somehow. And so she, you know, had all these bullet holes and indentations. And every time she was, and she's young, you know, every time she's at a pool, people are asking her what happened. So she had to constantly relive that amazingly traumatic story. But I think she was also the most uplifting in the sense that, you know, puts things in perspective. If this woman finds a reason to smile every day, you know, what real problems do we have in comparison?
Yeah, very, very well said. In one of the episodes, there was actually a fellow Persian Jewish woman who came in. What was that like for you?
I was actually proud of her because I think the Persian Jewish community is like all about appearances sometimes. And you know, even if you're starving, you're still driving a Mercedes. It might be a used Mercedes, but you're still driving a Mercedes, right? Because you want your kids to marry well. So I was actually really proud of her of sharing her story, because I think in the community, you know, stories like that or talking about any sort of weakness or, you know, she just had, you know, terrible acne scarring and had been through a lot of treatments. And for her to share her story, I thought was incredibly brave, especially with the community that we live in and sort of the expectations.
Yeah, yeah. Now, on the Persian Jewish community, there's this recent thing where Jews are equated with being white. And, you know, Zionism is then seen as a form of white supremacy. It's a whole ridiculous thing. But I kind of want to get your perspective because, you know, a lot of Persian Jews are not white passing. So when this kind of thing comes up, like, how do you think about that? Where do you fit in as a Persian Jewish person?
Well, first, I just hate that the conversation's even happening. And so sometimes when I'm, you know, people ask me that question, and I'm a person of color, technically, if you look up the definition of a person of color, you know, I'm brown. And certainly was not white passing. And actually I considered I guess I never even thought about it. I remember, my prom date was very fair skinned, this guy from Virginia, And he told me something about like us having an interracial relationship or something like that. And I was like, I'm not white. Wait, what? Like, it wasn't even a thought that I ever had, even though, you know, clearly I'm not. So even the fact that this conversation is happening is problematic to me. And I hate even engaging in the conversation because it gives validity to that thought process. I hate it. But since the conversation's happening, we have to make sure that we're a part of it, right? And that we're not me, because I'd probably go off, but somebody who's, you know, a little bit calmer than me and probably a lot more patient with that mentality, who maybe hasn't lived my life and doesn't have the traumas and maybe doesn't, you know, get so touchy about real oppression versus all the opportunities that everyone has in America. But yeah, I do think that there are certain things that maybe I can say as a brown person that maybe if a lighter skinned Jewish person said wouldn't be received similarly, but I hate that. Like, I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to give validation to that.
What, I mean, you have children. What are your, concerns for Jewish children right now? What challenges are young Jewish people facing?
I think the tough part right now about the US is the censorship. But I do think that there is a backlash to censorship that's starting. And so what I fear for young people these days, and why I actually started my activism, is my daughter was 4 years away from college. And I didn't want her going to college and not being able to tell her opinions and to talk to people about how maybe they should see the world in a different way or her experience. What's the point of college if everyone's talking the same way and censoring what they actually think? That's not what college is about. College is about meeting people of different backgrounds and thinking processes and having discussions and debates and, you know, late night, you know, hashing things out. That's what college is all about. And so I was like, wait, if I don't start speaking up about Judaism and being a proud Jew, how is my daughter going to go bring that message to people in college who maybe have never met a Jewish person before, or maybe haven't thought about things, or maybe don't know things that my daughter knows? And so I think the thing that is most concerning about young people is young people want to fit in, right? And so I'm worried that they're going to self-censor or try to assimilate in a way that's not genuine to themselves, or try to shape themselves in such a way that's not authentic to themselves. Because that feeling sucks. That's depressing to me, right? I think it's a cause of depression, having to walk on eggshells all the time and being afraid to speak and, you know, making sure you're always saying the right thing. Like, that's not freedom. And so my message, I guess, is my family left everything to bring us to America so we could say what we think. And now on my social media, when I say what I think, people call me a hero. No. The U.S. is made for that. That's what the U.S. is all about. Freedom of thought, freedom of speech. So exercise your right.
It's good advice, I think. Now, look, you've won many awards and honors throughout your career, one of which was the Iranian Jewish Women's Organization 2016 Woman of the Year Award, which is a pretty big deal, right? I mean, what was that like to receive that award?
I think it's wonderful. You know, I always like to, whenever I receive any accolades or any awards, I always try to include my children and my husband and take them on stage with me and speak to them. I always want them to see in me, even if they, you know, say things like, you're so embarrassing, or like things like that, that, you know, normal teenage kids say to their parents. I know that, you know, we're getting through to them, and I know that they're proud, and I want them to see that, you know, God rewards the authentic, and to, they can change what they think, they can grow, they can talk, and to kind of, you know, never compromise that.
Yeah. Now let's talk about your podcast, The Closet. It involves you interviewing people from your closet, which is where you are right now. This is a very unique concept. How and why did you come up with this?
So I used to do a lot of live sessions from my closet. People love the wardrobe. I was never really into like fashion growing up. I think I was just such a nerd and I was always studying. And I remember when I got engaged to my husband, I didn't own one dress. I literally had to go out and buy like 12 dresses because Persians have so many parties when engagements happen. But you know, slowly it just became a an artistic expression. And so I always think of also as moms, sometimes we find refuge in our closet. Like I don't meditate, I organize my sock drawer or something like that. So the closet kind of became a place of refuge, of thought, of artistic expression. And so I just thought this would be the perfect place to do the podcast.
That's awesome. What have some of the highlights been from the podcast?
Oh my gosh, so many. It's kind of like therapy for me. So our first guest was Megan McCain, and she is such a rock star, and we had an amazing conversation. Nate Bazulik from Vampire Diaries and The Originals was our second guest, and he has such an amazing and powerful spirituality. And so I think a lot of the things that he said really resonated with me, and still I kind of carry that with me. We had Yeonmi Park, who's one of 200 people to escape North Korea. And so she has an incredible story as well. We brought on Emily Austin, who's a sports journalist, who's very outspoken and found amazing success. And she's only 21. We've brought Dumasani Washington, who I always say he's like Martin Luther King Jr. reincarnated, so knowledgeable about Black and Jewish history and Black history in general. And so, yeah, we're just bringing on really cool, outspoken, not just activists, but just people who like kind of go against the grain a little bit and bring a perspective that you might not have considered before. Thankfully, through the show and Instagram, I have access to so many cool people. So I'm just trying to share their stories with my audience.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, Dr. Nazarian, I'm going to ask you a question that I ask all of our guests. If someone who is not Jewish approaches you and says that they want to help in the fight against anti-Semitism, where should they start?
You know, I think it's, you can always start in your own capacity. And I think speaking up when you witness it, I think is very powerful, or just calling people out when you witness it, I think is really important. Supporting activists or people on social media, even if it's just a message that says, oh, I didn't hear that side of the story before. What you posted made me go read up on some books, and now I understand better. And so just little messages like that to kind of encourage people who are putting, you know, their careers or social media following on the line. I think when I started my activism, I had 100,000 more followers than I do now. So I always say I lose some, gain some, but it's, I think as of like this week, the bleeding has stopped. So I think just, you know, supportive comments, calling out, you know, injustices when you witness them, being an ally, speaking up for the Jewish people, sharing posts that you think would be informative for your friends, all of those things. I think, you know, everyone has their own capacity to do something. And so whatever it is that you feel comfortable doing, just go one tiny step beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, please tell the listeners, what have you got going on and where can people find you?
So I'm most active probably on Instagram at Dr. Sheila Nazarian. Of course, the podcast is called The Closet. I hope you enjoy that. And, you know, I'm in Beverly Hills in private practice. My probably biggest website is nazarianplasticsurgery.com. And yeah, so would love to hear more from your listeners, love engaging on social media, and certainly pitching a couple more shows right now. Hopefully I'll have some good news for you soon.
Yeah, let us know. Dr. Nazarian, thank you so much for coming on Podcast Against Anti-Semitism.
Ellie, thank you so much for this podcast and for what you do, and wishing you much success.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Podcast Against Antisemitism. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a nice rating, or email any feedback to podcast@antisemitism.org. Until next Thursday, stay safe.